It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The landmark U.S. Supreme Court rulings on Obamacare and same-sex marriage late last month overshadowed some other very interesting decisions that were handed down. And this hour, we want to talk mainly about some of the decisions handed down by Iowa's Supreme Court this past session. And joining me to do that, our regular legal expert, Todd Pettis, is with us, Associate Dean for Faculty and the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. Thanks for coming into our studio, Todd.
Thanks for inviting me back. I appreciate it.
We have a number of fascinating cases, and as cases have interesting stories behind them, and also interesting law that gets explored in each one of them. Let's start, if we could, by having you remind us of a case that we reported on here on Iowa Public Radio, got quite a bit of coverage, and also was watched nationally. Iowa, one of a handful of states to expand abortion access in recent years due to something called telemedicine. It connects doctors and patients remotely. But the use of telemedicine for abortion was challenged in this case. Tell us what the case was about.
Well, it started with Planned Parenthood, as many of these cases do. And Planned Parenthood runs a variety of clinics across the state. Three of them are staffed by physicians in Des Moines, Iowa City, and Ames. And in those clinics, the woman who's thinking about or has decided to terminate the pregnancy can go to that clinic. She will meet face-to-face with the physician and other medical personnel, and the procedure will be performed there. Due to costs and perhaps other reasons, Planned Parenthood does not have physicians in all of their clinics. So there are some clinics where there's not a licensed physician on site. And so what Planned Parenthood was doing and what was challenged in this case was, as you say, telemedicine with abortion. So the woman would come into the clinic. There would be a staff member there who was medically trained but not a physician, who would take blood pressure and temperature, perform an ultrasound, those kinds of things, and then send the results to one of the physicians in one of the three other clinics. There's a live video link. So the woman who has come in for the procedure is in one room in one city, the physicians in another, and they're talking to each other live on a video. The test results are sent to the physician, and then if the physician decides to go ahead with the procedure, this is all for the use of, as I understand, RU486, the so-called morning after pill. If the physician decides that it's appropriate to go ahead with the procedure, the physician hits a button or a computer key or something, and that remotely unlocks a drawer or a container of some sort in the clinic where the woman is, and it unlocks it, and it's inside that container that the pill can be found. And this went on for some time. The Iowa Board of Medicine, which is the entity in the state that licenses doctors and regulates them, the Iowa Board of Medicine in 2013 adopted a rule banning this procedure, saying that primarily for the safety of the woman, there should be a face-to-face encounter between the woman and the doctor. The doctor should personally perform the physical exam. The doctor should personally be present when the medication is administered. And so they banned the practice, and Planned Parenthood was challenged.
Out of safety concerns was the claim.
Those are the reasons that the Iowa Board of Medicine recited when adopting the rule. That's right.
And a district court agreed with that.
Yeah, and so when it went up to the upheld the rule, that's right. And when it went up to the Iowa Supreme Court, one of the first things the court has to do is, look at, what's the governing body of law? What is the body of law that sets the standards that we're going to apply today? And abortion rights, as we understand them, we talk about Roe and Planned Parenthood. Those are all federal Supreme Court rulings interpreting the federal Constitution. Mm-hmm. It is possible that the Iowa Constitution also protects a right to an abortion. And if it does, it is possible that the Iowa Constitution provides even more protection for the abortion right than the federal Constitution. I'm not saying that it does. What I am saying is that's an issue that the Iowa Supreme Court has never addressed.
So also in this case, the Iowa Supreme Court was looking not at the right to abortion either in the Iowa Constitution or in the U.S. Constitution?
No, it's looking at the right to abortion, and ultimately they decide they're going to decide the case under the federal standards mm-hmm. and under the federal Constitution. And the reason why is that the Iowa Board of Medicine, the entity that was restricting access to this form of abortion, that entity conceded for the purposes of this case that under the Iowa Constitution, there is a right to abortion, and the right under the Iowa Constitution gets exactly the same amount and kind of protection as the federal Constitution provides. And so in this case, the Iowa Supreme Court did not have to say anything about whether there's a right to abortion under the Iowa Constitution, and if so, how much protection does it provide? I'm just flagging as a potential issue that's, you know, probably going to come up at some point down the road. There will be a case where the Iowa Supreme Court looks at the facts, applies the federal standard, and says, under the federal standard, this restriction on abortion is fine. Now, does the Iowa Constitution provide even more? They didn't have to reach that issue here because they found that in this case, on these facts, the Iowa Board of Medicine's rule could not survive the federal standard. And the federal standard comes from the famous case from the early 90s, the federal Supreme Court case, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which prescribes an undue burden test.
Mm-hmm. So with this Planned Parenthood victory in this case, the U.S., the Iowa Supreme Court deciding in favor of Planned Parenthood and not in favor of the Iowa Board of Medicine, does this end the story? Does it go on from here?
Well, with respect to telemedicine and abortion, that ends the issue in Iowa. The Iowa Supreme Court has said that it violates the federal constitution and, at least for the sake of argument, the Iowa Constitution. But the focus here again was on federal law. It imposes an undue burden on the woman who's seeking to terminate an early term pregnancy. And because the Iowa Constitution forbids it, that's where it ends. Now, whether the Iowa Board of Medicine has plans to, you know, come up with a different version of a rule that, you know, might raise a different set of facts or legal issues, I don't know. But
I know politics isn't your field, but of course politics do enter court decisions all the time, and especially ones that concern abortion. Charges of playing politics here when the district court decided one way, when the Iowa Supreme Court reversed that decision. There were cries of pure politics here. I don't know if you had a comment on that.
No, I do have a comment on that. I think that charge would be quite unfair in this case. Our justices do come from political backgrounds, and they were unanimous in this case. We're going to talk today about some cases where the justices were divided, but in this case, the justices of the Iowa Supreme Court were all of one mind. They all agreed that on these facts, the Iowa Board of Medicine's rule violated the federal constitution. And when they are all agreeing that that's how the case ought to come out, I think that's a pretty strong signal that it's not, well, the left on the court kind of took over the objection of the right.
Mm-hmm.
All the justices looked at this case. They looked at the standard that had been prescribed by the federal Supreme Court in the Casey case, and they all agreed that the Iowa Board of Medicine's rule was unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mentioned at the outset that Iowa is among a handful of states that has expanded abortion access through telemedicine. Supposing that telemedicine is used in an increasing number of states for abortion procedures, does the Iowa decision here have any bearing on other states that will eventually perhaps use telemedicine in this way?
It doesn't have any legal bearing. No other state is required to follow what the Iowa Supreme Court has said, but state Supreme Courts do look to one another just for whatever persuasive power another state's handling of an issue might have. And so when teleabortion comes up, you know, name your state, when it comes up there, the parties will undoubtedly be talking to the – in that case, they'll undoubtedly be talking to the court about what the Iowa Supreme Court did and what their reasons were. But it will be up to that other state Supreme Court then to decide for itself. Do they find the Iowa approach persuasive or do they reject it?
Todd Pettis is with us, if you've just joined us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Todd joins us regularly, several times a year, to talk us through some of the most interesting cases, both in the U.S. Supreme Court and today's case, the Iowa Supreme Court, the just past session here, going through some of the cases, how they were decided, and of course telling us the stories with it. Todd is with the University of Iowa College of Law, where he is Associate Dean for faculty. And let's talk about another case. I was seeing in the Des Moines Register the headline when this case was decided in the Des Moines Register, Iowa Supreme Court affirms right to be drunk on front porch, was the headline. Tell us the story here.
Yeah, it involves a woman with a name I love. I don't know her, but her name was Patience Pay, like patience as in have patience. Patience Pay. Patience Pay called 911 to her home in Waterloo for a domestic dispute. When the officers arrived, she came out onto the front porch of her house to meet the officers. The officers then have a conversation with her. They also have a conversation with other people who are in the house. And the legal story doesn't have anything to do with it, whatever domestic disturbance there may or may not have been. It all has to do with the fact that Ms. Pay was standing outside her home on the front porch, evidently under the influence of alcohol. Officers gave her a breathalyzer test, and it was fairly high. I think it was in 0.26, something in that neighborhood. And so they cited her for public intoxication.
Even though she was on her own front porch.
She's at her own home. It's not an apartment building. That might have mattered. I'll get to that in a second. But this is a single-family dwelling, you know, so private property. She's on her front porch. She's come out to talk to the officers, and the court never made anything of those facts. But she's the only reason she's left the house and gone outdoors, albeit on her porch, was to talk to the law enforcement people, mm-hmm. whom she had telephoned for some assistance. But anyway, when the officers left, she was holding a public intox citation in her hand. Iowa is one of the few states, I don't have the numbers, but the Iowa Supreme Court itself noted this, I think, in a footnote in this ruling. Iowa is one of the few cases, a few states to make public intoxication itself a crime. You know, all states, of course, have laws banning the doing of certain things, particularly driving, while under the influence of mm-hmm. alcohol. But just the fact of being intoxicated in a public place is a crime. The Iowa statute also says that it's a crime to pretend that you're intoxicated in public. We don't have any cases about that where someone is acting like a drunk person and cited for it. But under the language of the law, I don't know whether the Iowa Supreme Court would uphold that the statute in a case like that. But in this case, there wasn't much of a dispute, I don't think, about the fact that Ms. Pay was intoxicated. The question was she in a public place? Mm-hmm. And the Iowa statute says that a public place is any place to which the public has access. Okay, so if you live in a single-family dwelling, or you certainly know what they look like if you don't, picture yourself standing on your front porch. Are you in a public place? And we're obviously in a bit of a gray area here. On the one hand, when the Girl Scouts want to come sell you cookies, or the trick-or-treaters come on Halloween, or the door-to-door salesperson comes and they knock, the public does physically have access to that porch. You can then ask them to leave, but they do have access to it in a way that they don't have access to your dining room. You know, you're not sitting at your dining room table and then someone peeks their head around the corner and says, do you want to buy cookies or something? They stop at the door. And so the court had to decide, was this a public place? They were unanimous in this case too. And they said that she was not in a public place, and so the citation, she was not guilty of public intoxication within the meaning of this statute. Why not? Well, number one, she had a legal right to tell any members of the public who might come upon her porch that they needed to leave, and that's certainly true. And she hadn't invited the public.
She invited the police, but
she had invited the police, but she had not issued any kind of invitation to the public. And so you think, okay, so now what kinds of future cases then might come up where the court has to say, let's return to this issue. So to think about those future cases, let me just tell you about one more past case. It's about 10 years ago or so. The court had said that if you live in an apartment building, if you're on the front steps of the apartment building or in the hallway that runs perhaps, you know, indoors along the apartments, that is a public place. So that's been the law in Iowa now, again, for about a decade. So if you're in an apartment building, we already knew before Ms. Pei's case came along that if you were drunk on the front porch or in the hallway, even though you lived in the building, you were not in your unit. You were in a public place because members of the public can come there, you know, to look around, not for a single-family dwelling. So what kind of cases does that leave unresolved? The best example, I think, would be a yard sale on your private property in your house.
Garage, on your yard.
Yeah. Those areas where you have a legal right to exclude the public if you want. Suppose you invite them in so that Saturday morning, you know, from 8 until noon or something, during that time, the public does have access to your yard because you've invited them there. And the person running the yard sale, I won't make this you, is heavily intoxicated at the time. Are they in it then at that moment in a public place? Think back again to Ms. Pei's fact. She's inebriated and she's on her front porch. She said, we can't believe the Iowa legislature meant to criminalize this. Surely they didn't mean to make it a crime. This was the court's example, to sit on your porch and sip a mojito on a sunny afternoon. They also said, and surely they didn't also mean to make it a crime if you're out drinking, you have a designated driver who drives you home. So you're doing the responsible thing.
Right.
You know, you've given someone else the keys. They drive you home. You're walking from the car up to the house. You're on the front porch. You're stumbling. An officer drives by and sees you. Surely the legislature didn't mean to make that a crime. But if you think about, well, before you get to the front steps, when you get out of the car, and so you walk up the sidewalk towards your house, if the officer drives by then, you are in a public place. You haven't entered your private property yet.
Sidewalk is public.
The sidewalk is absolutely a public place, but you're trying to do the responsible thing. You've, you know, you've had too much to drink out at a bar one night, and you're trying to get home. So what you know, we need to be absolutely insulated from the law. We need some kind of invention that would be a private space, like a car is. The car itself, even though it's driving down a public roadway, when you're sitting in the passenger seat, very intoxicated, not driving, you're in the passenger seat, you're not committing a crime because the public doesn't have access to the inside of that car.
Right.
But when you step out of the car and begin to make your way towards your private property, you're in technically some legal jeopardy. Whether the Supreme Court would uphold a citation when you're in that little space, I don't know. Once you enter your private property, though, and you're on that area of land that where you have a legal right to exclude, it appears that so long as you at least haven't invited the public in, you have a right to be intoxicated there and can't be cited for public intoxication.
Fascinating case. And as you just pointed out, variations perhaps in the future yet to further define where and how you may legally be intoxicated. We're talking about Iowa Supreme Court cases with Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa College of Law, spending the hour having him tell us the stories behind these cases and the reasons, the arguments on each side and the way the court decided and the fallout, the implications of these cases. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We've got a few more minutes before we have to take a break, Todd. Let's talk about the case of a malfunctioning penny slot machine. A gambler at a casino, the Capri Casino, a fantasy that perhaps all of us have had of becoming a millionaire by playing a penny slot machine, but didn't in fact turn out this way. What happened?
Yeah, the name of the case is McKee versus Isle of Capri Casinos. This is from the summer of 2011. It's going to be another unanimous ruling, by the way, by the Iowa justices on this case. Pauline McKee was 87 years old at the time. She's attending a family reunion in Waterloo, and as part of the festivities, she's at the Isle Casino Hotel, and some other family members are staying there as well. And she is playing the Miss Kitty game. I don't know, I've never played the Miss Kitty game, but as a reading from the opinion, I gather you put in a small amount of change. It's called a penny slot, and I gather that means you can put as little as a penny in, but you can bet a little more. So she puts in 25 cents and some reels spin, some kind of, I assume they're digital little spinning reels, and if the same thing kind of lines up across the row, you know, then you win. So she puts in 25 cents and she wins $1.85. That's how much she clearly has won. And a little window pops up on the screen that any of us would be happy to see. And this window that pops up on the screen says, bonus award, $41,797,000, indicating to her that she had just won $41 million on her 25-cent bet. So she calls the hotel, the casino staff over. The staff, by all accounts, handle it very responsibly. They take a photograph of the screen, so there's not going to be an argument later about what this digital screen that can be unplugged at any moment, what did it or did not say. They take a photo of it. The hotel comps the family's rooms. They pay for the family's rooms because they're kind of indicating, you know, you're not walking out of here tonight with a check for what $41 million, but we want you to be a happy customer. So as I understand, the hotel tells the family there's not going to be a charge for the room, but we are going to take some time to investigate this. So they get the Iowa Racing and Gaming Commission involved, the government entity that regulates casinos in Iowa, and they conduct an investigation. They talk to the manufacturer of the game, and they say the machine was not supposed to do this. The machine malfunctioned, and so the casino gets back in touch with her and says, we're not writing the check, and so she files a lawsuit.
Right.
Saying, you owe me $41 million.
And the court decided how and for what reason?
Yeah.
Against this gambler, against her?
Yeah. Again, another unanimous ruling. They decide against her, and they say several different parts of the ruling. But the heart of it is, this is basically a contract. When you go, by offering you this machine, the casino is saying, if you put X amount of money in, here's what we will do in exchange. And there's apparently a little button you can hit on the machine. She didn't do it. Most of us, I assume, don't do it. But there's a little button you can hit that would pull up a copy of the rules, and you could read all of those. When you look at all those rules, there's nothing there about bonus awards. It's rules that would indicate that if certain things happen, you put in 25 cents, you're going to win $1.85. But there's nothing in the rules of the game that indicate this. So when she dropped that quarter in the machine, she was entering a contract with the casino. I'm going to put in this 25 cents, and in exchange, I have a chance to win $1.85 or some other, you know, reasonably manageable amount. Nothing in the rules, though, about $41 million. So the court says that's not part of the contract. It's some technological fluke, but it wasn't part of her legal agreement with the casino.
When we come back after a short break, Todd Pettis will tell us about a number of other cases, including a tragic drowning of two teenage boys at a community aquatics center, the aquatics center in Pella. Also, a case that started when a defendant was stopped for an expired license plate, and it got much more serious very quickly. We'll find out about those cases and what the Iowa Supreme Court decided. When we come back, it's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, spending the hour with Todd Pettis, the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. He comes to us, and we love to have him step into our studio to tell us about Supreme Court decisions, be they U.S. Supreme Court decisions or Iowa Supreme Court decisions. In this case, we're listening to the stories behind the Iowa Supreme Court decisions, some of them in this last session, what the arguments were and how the court decided and how they are relevant to our lives. Todd Pettis, let's go to a case of a drowning of two teenage boys. The story here, the drowning happening at a community aquatic center.
Yeah, it's just an absolutely heartbreaking case, I think, and it's timely. You know, it involves summertime and swimming pools and municipal swimming pools in particular. It's heartbreaking and horrifying all at the same time. So the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, as they had long been doing and may still be doing, was running a sports camp in the city of Pella, and it brings well over 100 kids. And one night, the Fellowship of Christian Athletes rents from the city of Pella the Pella Aquatic Center. And so, you know, it's kind of reserved for this private event, but it's huge. There's something like 160, 170 campers are there, 20 or 30 staff members and lifeguards. So a couple of hundred people are there. Now, before this doesn't turn out to play a role in the legal story, but it's just such a compelling story. The parents have been asked to sign waivers. The Fellowship of Christian Athletes, when they sent these kids off to camp, had said, tell us if your kid has any food allergies and so forth. And one of the things that parents were asked was, can your child swim? Either they're a non-swimmer, or they're beginning, intermediate, and so forth. And the two boys here in this story, their parents had both said, these kids are non-swimmers. They're not swimmers. Well, the Fellowship of Christian Athletes evidently does not bring those waivers with it that night to the pool, so the lifeguards are not put on notice that these couple of kids, evidently, according to the Des Moines Register's reporting on this, what happened instead was that they asked all of the kids, all of the campers themselves when they got there that night, can you swim? And if a child said no, then that child was not allowed to swim. If they said, yeah, barely, then they were watched carefully. These two boys evidently said that they could swim.
And of course, being in a situation with teenagers, who wants to be the two in the crowd who say, I can't do something?
Yeah, and one of the kids apparently had moved within the last half year or so from Haiti with his mother after Haiti had suffered earthquakes, and so kind of out of the wreckage of Haiti had come, and these boys had come up from, I think it was Kansas City. They weren't Iowans themselves, but, you know, they're coming to this camp, which is a big draw. Now, the lights in the swimming pool apparently were not on that night. There were lights installed in the bottom of the pool, but there had been long-running litigation with a contractor about those lights. The lights evidently had some rust on them, and so some city employees much earlier on, by which I think I mean years, had said, we're just not going to turn the lights on for these underwater lights. And so there's some people at least who say that night, it was an evening event, you couldn't see down to the bottom of the pool, both because the underwater lights were not on and evidently, you know, get that many people with suntan lotion and dirt and so forth, the water gets murky. Mm-hmm. And so there are at least some people say you couldn't see down to the bottom of the pool. Well, the time comes for the event to end. They're loading up the buses to take the kids back to where they're staying, and these two boys can't be accounted for. So they start searching desperately for these kids, not from the case, but from some press coverage. One of the lifeguards puts on goggles, goes down and starts looking in the pool, and they find the two boys' bodies near the bottom of the pool near the main drain. And they had apparently had been there for 45 minutes or an hour, had been there for a long time with kids swimming above them, having no idea because down the deep end, these two boys apparently had gone down some big slide. The press has reported that some kids overheard them talking about one of them saying, I'm nervous, I don't want to do it, or I'll go first, this kind of thing. But these two boys evidently went down this slide. It's a terrible story. And again, some of the press that came out through the Des Moines Register at that time, back in 2010, one child apparently says, I saw a boy's head come up. He looked to be struggling. He says something to his mom about it. The mom looks at the lifeguard. The lifeguard doesn't seem alarmed, so no steps are taken. Some other child apparently says, I felt someone grab my ankle, but then I didn't know what it was, or I saw kind of a dark shape under the water, but I didn't thought it was nothing. Mm. So for lots of reasons, these boys go unaccounted for a long time. So the children's parents have filed a lawsuit against the Fellowship of Christian Athletes and others, including the city of Pella, and that takes us to then the legal issue that was in front of the Iowa Supreme Court. Can the city be sued? Is the city liable? There's a statute in Iowa that kind of goes as follows. Cities, as a general matter, are liable when their employees are careless and people get hurt as a result. Okay, so that's kind of a starting point. Then there's some exceptions made to that. And one exception is for city-inspected swimming pools. So these would be swimming pools that either the city owns itself or that the city goes out and inspects. Okay, but if a city is inspecting swimming pools, as a general matter, that the city cannot be sued for bad things that happen at the swimming pool. And that is reflecting the General Assembly trying to do this balancing between, on the one hand, we know that swimming pools are dangerous places and people can get hurt badly there or die. On the other hand, it gets hot in Iowa. Swimming pools are popular places. We want to encourage cities to have swimming pools. And so on balance, we think cities shouldn't be liable when things go wrong there. But then there's an exception to that. They say, but we're going to put cities back on the hook. They will be on the hook if one of their employees commits a criminal offense. Okay? And so the issue here was, should we give the parents a chance to argue at trial that the employees who, you know, ordered the lights turned off or who kept the lights off and so forth, that they committed a criminal offense or that some city officials of some kind and not having adequate lighting there committed a criminal offense? Well, there's two possible criminal offenses that were at issue. On one of them, the justices were unanimous about what the answer should be. On the other, they were divided 4-3. The one on which they were unanimous has to do with involuntary manslaughter. The justices all agreed that they all agreed that the parents should be given a chance to prove at trial that the city employees, one or more of them, committed involuntary manslaughter. And involuntary manslaughter is basically doing something that ultimately hurts or kills someone, and you're doing it in a manner that's likely to cause some harm.
Reckless.
You don't intend to hurt anybody, but you're doing something that's pretty clearly foolish, and you should know someone's going to get hurt. And they all agreed these parents should have a shot at proving that. So unless the case settles, the case will go to trial on that issue. It will also be going to trial on a second issue, and this is the one the court divided on 4-3, and that is whether violating basically the state's swimming pool regulations, whether a violation of those regulations counts as a criminal offense. And four justices said that it did. That's a decision that weighs heavily in the parents' favor because those regulations say, for example, that you always should have lighting that is adequate to enable you to see the bottom of the pool. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty clear, or at least according to some people, that that was not the case at the pool that night. And you can't have the water be murky so that you can't see the bottom of the pool. So, again, unless the case settles, this case will be going to trial on those issues.
So other community aquatic centers around Iowa taking notice because of this case, doing anything different? Should we see any change of behavior perhaps based on this case?
Well, I would think so. I would hope so. Even just setting the law aside, it's a reminder of what can happen when teenagers or kids show up at a swimming pool. But the notion that violating even a Department of Public Health swimming pool regulation counts as a criminal offense. There were three justices on the court who thought that that should not be counted as a criminal defense, criminal offense. Involuntary manslaughter, yes, but not these other things. And the dissent points out, well, there's all kinds of regulations. You know, you got to have soap in the restrooms and these other things. Really, you violate any of those regulations, you're committing a criminal offense. But according to a majority of the court, yes. And so what those regulations demand, I would imagine that at swimming pools all across the state, the folks who are running them are taking a close look and I hope holding some training sessions about what's required of them.
Todd Pettis is with us. We have about 10 or so minutes left, Todd, to get through a few other cases. That was Sanon v. City of Pella, one of the cases decided before the Iowa Supreme Court in its last session, working our way through some of the more significant cases that were decided. Todd telling us the stories behind them and talking about the decisions and the significance of the decisions. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's talk about this case, Todd, if we could, that started when a defendant was stopped for an expired license plate.
Yeah, this is Jesse Gaskins, who's pulled over in winter of 2012. Davenport police pull over his van because of the expired plate. Officer comes up to the van and smells marijuana. Apparently the smell is pretty strong. There's an exchange between the officer and Mr. Gaskins. And ultimately, Mr. Gaskins admits that he has at least a marijuana joint with him. So the police arrest him and his companion and put them back in the patrol car. So there's no one in the van. Another officer shows up, and while these guys are secured in the patrol car, the police proceed to search the van. They don't have a search warrant. but they're searching the van anyway. They see behind the driver's seat a locked safe of some kind. I mean, Al Gore would call it a lockbox. Remember the lockbox?
Yes.
Yeah, well, Social Security or whatever he was talking about putting there. Well, this locked box had a gun and a lot of marijuana in it. It was locked at the time the officers saw it, but they saw the key ring, which is still apparently there in the van. There's some keys on that. And the officer, I wonder if one of those keys goes to this. Without a warrant, uses the key to open up the box. And the legal question was, did that violate Mr. Gaskin's search and seizure rights? And the court divided 4-3 in this case. They held that it did. One of the things that makes this case legally significant, it's not just the facts here, you know, but this case falls in a line of cases that have begun to emerge over the last 4 or 5 years, and it's an issue on which our justices seem to be increasingly sharply divided, with some pretty powerful feelings on both sides, which is when the Iowa Constitution has a provision like a protection against unreasonable searches and seizures, and when the federal Constitution has a similarly worded provision, how closely should we follow the federal precedent? Should we say that the state constitution demands the same thing as the federal constitution, or should we not? Mm-hmm. A majority of the court has appeared in this area of the law increasingly willing to deviate from the approach the federal Supreme Court has taken and to grant more protection, and that's what they did here. Under the federal Fourth Amendment, it was permissible for the officers to search this locked box. The cases are pretty clear about that. But under the Iowa Constitution, a majority of the court said we have even more protection against unreasonable searches and seizures. And here a warrant was required.
Todd Pettis with us of the University of Iowa College of Law. Sanford v. Lawler is a case that you point to as significant in the past session of the Iowa Supreme Court. Tell us the story here.
Yeah, well, just it involves facts that you can imagine different permutations of that come up quite a bit. So the Fillenworth Beach is apparently a resort on Lake Okoboji, and lots of people show up there to stay there one weekend in the summer of 2011. And one of the amenities of staying at the resort is that, you know, included in the price is you get to go out on a boat and have alcoholic beverages, among some other things. When you go out on the boat and have the beverages, you don't have to pull out your wallet and pay for it. It's one of the amenities of being a guest resort. Words are exchanged between different guests there. They get off the boat, and later a fight breaks out, and one of the guests assaults the other while drunk and is drunk in large part because of alcohol that the resort had served to him. There's an Iowa statute, the Dram Shop Act or the Dram Shop Statute, that says that if you are a licensed alcohol seller and you sell alcohol to someone, you serve it to them, and you should know that they're already drunk, then you're liable for any of the harm they go off while drunk and cause. And so the man who was assaulted here has sued the resort, saying, well, you sold and served alcohol to this guy. He was obviously drunk. You shouldn't have done it, so you should have to pay for the harm that I suffered. And the justices were unanimous on this, the question being, when you're on the boat and you don't have to take out your wallet, they give you the alcohol, as many drinks as you want, are they selling it to you? And the court said, yes, it's one of the amenities that you get as a guest.
So the bartender should have been aware of how inebriated the people were.
Yeah. Now, I don't know what their website said before this happened, but I looked at their website this morning, and the resort's website this morning says that one of the amenities of staying there is you get to go on these cruises, and they say each cruise features a complimentary alcoholic drink or two.
Okay, so that's so been changed.
They may be reining in how much they serve, but it's a reminder that those who do sell alcohol are legally on the hook for what harm may come down the road.
Juvenile sentencing has been in our news a lot in the past year, and it's also been something that the Iowa Supreme Court has addressed. How?
Well, this is most recently from late June of this summer. It's the state of Iowa versus seats, like the seat of your pants, but with an S at the end. This is concerns a young man who, while 17 years old, a few months shy of his 18th birthday, murdered somebody, went to someone's house thinking he was going to be killing one person, sees someone sleeping on the couch, shoots this person multiple times in the back. It turns out it's not the intended victim, but that's neither here nor there. The man is the victim is dead, and he is sentenced to life without parole. And it's a big issue in the federal courts. It's an issue here in state courts too, under both the federal constitution and the state. When can you tell someone who, while a juvenile, commits a crime, when can you tell them that they will never see the light of day again, that they will be in prison for the rest of their life, no chance of parole? That's an issue that our federal Supreme Court has been grappling with, and here they're grappling with it too. This particular case does not yet have a big kind of headline outcome. What the court sent it back for resentencing and careful consideration of some factors. But what really signals some headlines to come is some thinking that some of the justices publicly did about whether life without parole for juveniles categorically violates the Iowa Constitution. Is there anything in our Iowa Constitution that says we don't care what they did, you can never send a juvenile to prison for the rest of their life with no chance of parole? Three justices have said in this case, we don't think there's any categorical bar. If the case is bad enough, that's an appropriate punishment. One justice went on record and said, I think it does categorically violate the Iowa Constitution. These will be issues that undoubtedly we'll see the justices return to.
Mm-hmm. We have just a couple minutes left. I'd like to pivot over to have you comment on the U.S. Supreme Court. Of course, the dust is settling on some momentous decisions at the U.S. Supreme Court level. I wanted to have you just comment, if you could, on the historic nature of this. It sure seems, as a member of the media, the news media, that this is every U.S. Supreme Court session is historic in certain ways, but this seems more historic than others. Is that your sense as well?
Well, the same-sex marriage ruling is going to be the ruling that this most recent term, most recent year, will stand in history for, both for the fact of, you know, the outcome that there is now nationwide a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. That's quite, you know, anyone who would have foreseen that 10 years ago would have had pretty remarkable foresight. The speed of change there has been pretty astonishing. And also, from the legal point of view, the nature of the opinions. Justice Kennedy wrote for a majority. If anyone who, you know, has got an extra half hour or 45 minutes in their day, it's the Obergefell ruling. You can find it alphabetically on the Supreme Court's website. It starts with an O, O-B-E-R. The justices' rhetoric, particularly in the dissent against the majority, could not have been more clearly on absolutely opposite ends of
the issue. From Justice Scalia, mainly.
Justice Scalia, Chief Justice Roberts, and then Justices Alito and Thomas also filing dissenting opinions, thinking that this was absolutely an abuse of federal judicial power. Courts have no business making these decisions. Chief Justice Roberts says, you know, celebrate, because I know it's a happy outcome, but don't celebrate the Constitution. It had nothing to do with this. And by the way, you would have been much better off long term for your cause and your movement if you had continued to persuade voters to go your way, as you were doing with increasing success. Now you bring all that debate to a halt. This gets imposed as a judicial matter. Whether he's right about that, you know, what will we be saying about same-sex rights a few years from now? Does this killing off a Democrat debate in a harmful way, or is it not? Those will be interesting things to watch.
What can you tell us in about a minute about the next session? Do you have there cases on the docket already?
Yeah, two big cases. I'm a little biased because I work in a university, so one that certainly interests me but will also draw national headlines is the University of Texas at Austin is back in front of the court concerning one of its race-based admissions programs. So we'll be looking at affirmative action in higher education once again. And there's also a major case involving public sector unions and whether people who work for the government and don't themselves belong to the union, whether they can nevertheless be forced to pay the union for the collective bargaining services that the union provides and that all employees get the benefit of. Some justices, Justice Alito, principal among them, have signaled that this might be a violation of the First Amendment. There's an old Supreme Court case that says it's okay, but some justices have been really pushing to revisit the issue. And if that rule goes against the unions, it's going to be a major blow for unions across the country.
Mm-hmm. Very quickly before we have to go, any Any further thoughts on possible retirements in the U.S. Supreme Court?
It doesn't look like it's going to be this year. I think, you know, Justice Ginsburg is the one people have had their eyes on. There haven't been any indications that she's planning on not being there next year. Now that we're well into July, it looks like the nine justices are going to be the familiar faces.
Okay. Todd Pettis, the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. Todd, always enlightening to have you stop by and explain the legalities of these cases at the Iowa Supreme Court level or the U.S. Supreme Court. Thanks, Todd, for coming in.
Thanks for letting me spend this time with you.
And that's it for today. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. You can contact us anytime. Here's our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.